Hi.
I'm going to talk today about Ironies in Blue. Mostly the book is a history of the police in the United States. It actually begins in the colonial period before there was this modern institution of police. And it examines how these guys with the blue uniforms and the squad cars that we're all familiar with evolved out of earlier sort of pre-modern law enforcement institutions. And in particular, it traces their evolution from an institution called slave patrols, which was specifically responsible for regulating the lives of slaves in the South. And then it follows the story for, you know, approximately the next 200 years, looking at how the police have changed during that time and the social forces that have shaped that. I'm not actually going to talk very much in the next little bit about that history. If you want to know about it, ask me during the question and answer. I'll be glad to sum it up. Instead, I'm going to talk about policing and violence. And I thought that that would probably be a good thing to focus on given recent events here in Oakland, in particular the murder of Oscar Grant and also the shootout with Lavelle Nixon and the four cops who died as a result of that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about police use of violence, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the police being the victims of violence. And while I'm thinking of it, I am going to turn off my cell phone, and if everybody else would do the same thing, I'd appreciate it. So I'm going to read a little bit from the first chapter of my book, which is called Police Brutality in Theory and Practice. This is the second edition. When this came out, it had only been a couple years since the first edition, so I didn't bother updating the statistics because they don't really change that much. But I figured since I was giving a talk, it'd be best if I had the most recent statistics. So if you look at the book later and the stats you see there are different than the ones I'm giving you now, it's because I went and did more research in preparation for the talk. It's not that I'm just making things up. We're encouraged to think of acts of police violence more or less in isolation, to consider them as unique, unrelated occurrences. We ask ourselves always what went wrong, and for answers, we look to the seconds, minutes, or hours before the incident. Perhaps this leads us to fault the individual officer. Perhaps it leads us to excuse him. Such thinking, derived as it is from legal reasoning, does not take us far beyond the case in question, and thus such inquiries are rarely very illuminating. Of the famous instances of police violence, the shooting of Timothy Thomas, the beating of Rodney King, the arrest of Marquette Frye, the killing of Arthur McDuffie, and now we can add the murder of Oscar Grant, any of these may be explained in terms of the actions and attitudes of the particular officers at the scene, the events preceding the violence, including the actions of the victims, and the circumstances in which the officers found themselves. Indeed, some police administrators have frequently found it possible to excuse police violence with just such explanations. The unrest that followed these incidents, however, cannot be explained in such narrow terms. To understand the rioting, one must consider the whole range of related issues, including the conditions of life in the black community, the role of the police in relation to that community, and the history and pattern of similar abuses. If we are to understand the phenomenon of police brutality, we must get beyond particular cases. We can better understand the actions of individual police officers if we understand the institution of which they are a part. That institution, in turn, can best be examined if we have an understanding of its origins, its social function, and its relation to larger systems like capitalism and white supremacy. Let's begin with the basics. Violence is an inherent part of policing. The police represent the most direct means by which the state imposes its will on the citizenry. When persuasion, indoctrination, moral pressure, and incentive measures all fail, there are the police. In the field of social control, the police are specialists in violence. They are armed, trained, and authorized to use force. With varying degrees of subtlety, this colors their every action. Like the possibility of arrest, the threat of violence is implicit in every police encounter. Violence, as well as the law, is what they represent. According to a 2005 Justice Department survey, 19% of the American public had direct contact with the police during the previous year. I'm using the most recent stats available, so there's nothing magical about 2005. That's just the last year for which the figures are in. Most of these contacts took the form of traffic stops, and most were unremarkable. Only 1.6% involved the use or threat of force. Now, that may not sound like a lot until you realize that 1.6% is a polite way of saying nearly 500,000 people, an estimated 435,000. 400,000 people, if we got them all together, would make for a fair-sized city, larger than Atlanta, Georgia, and almost as large as Fresno, California. And when you orient yourself to the fact that this city could be reproduced every year, you start to get some picture of how common police violence really is. Another way of looking at the figures is that out of every 100 people that the police come in contact with, they will threaten or use force against one or two of them. This rate is more than twice as high for black people, 4.4%. According to a one-time Justice Department study of six police agencies, police use force in 17.1% of all adult custody cases, or 18.9% if we include threats of force. Suspects, in contrast, use force against the police in less than 3% of arrest cases. More specifically, suspects employ weaponless tactics in 1.9% of arrests and use weapons in 0.7%. Meanwhile, the police use weaponless tactics in 15.8% and use weapons in about 2.1% of arrests. The police, in short, use force far more often than it is used against them. This is important because the danger of the job is a constant theme in the defense of police violence. By pointing to the dangers of the job, the apologists don't only defend police actions in particular circumstances, which might actually have been dangerous, but as often as not take the opportunity to mount a general defense. This is a clever bit of sophistry. It's as cynical as a Memorial Day speech during wartime. It's one thing to make a banner of the bloody uniform when discussing a case where the cops actually were in danger, but quite another to do so when they only might have been, or only thought that they were. The fact that policing is risky, by this view, seems to justify in advance whatever measures the police feel necessary to employ. Its genius is that it's so hard to answer. Few people are indifferent to the death of a police officer, especially when they feel, though usually only in a vague, patriotic kind of way, that it occurred because the officer was selflessly working so that you and I and our families and children could walk the streets at night. The flaw of the hero defense, however, is simple. Policing is not so dangerous as we're led to believe. During the 5 years ending with 2007, again, these are the most recent statistics available, 269 cops were murdered and 379 died in accidents. To take the most recent figures, 140 cops died in 2007, with that number representing 57 murders and 83 accidents. So accidents are far more common than murders. Naturally, it's not to be lost sight of that these numbers represent human lives and not widgets or sacks of potatoes. But let's remember that there were also 5,488 total fatal work injuries in 2007. Policing may be dangerous, but it is not the most dangerous job available. In terms of total fatalities, more truck drivers are killed than any other kind of worker. 908 in 2007. Could I get the slide, please? So a better measure of occupational risk is the rate of work-related deaths per 100,000. This is a graph provided by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In 2007, for example, it was 26.2 for truck drivers. The police are... Okay, so here are fishers at 111.8. All the way down here are police and sheriff patrol officers at 21.4, making policing slightly less dangerous than collecting the garbage.
What is the red? I don't know.
Okay, this is the blue is the fatality rate, the number per 100,000, and the red is the total number. So more drivers and sales workers and truck drivers died, 908. But there are so many of those that only brings it to 26.2 per 100,000 workers. So this is the more important graph. Where are the headlines, the memorials, the honor guards, the sorrowful rendering of taps for these other workers? Where are the mayoral speeches, the newspaper editorials, the sober reflections that these brave men and women died and others risked their lives daily so that we might continue to enjoy the benefits of modern society? I mean, after all, we can't just do without somebody collecting garbage. But it seems that policing is the only industry that both exaggerates and advertises its dangers. It has done so at a high cost and to a great advantage, though, as is often the case, the costs are not borne by the same people who reap the benefits. The overblown image of police heroism and the obsession with officer safety do not only serve to justify police violence after the fact, but by providing such justification, they legitimize violence and thus make it more likely. The exaggerated sense of danger has helped to reorder police priorities to the detriment of public interest. Put the slide away. Police brutality does not just happen. It is allowed to happen. It is tolerated by the police themselves, those on the street, and those in command. It's tolerated by prosecutors who seldom bring charges against violent cops and by juries who rarely convict. It's tolerated by the civil authorities, the mayors, and the city councils who refuse to use their influence to challenge police abuses. But why? The answer is simple. Police brutality is tolerated because it is what people with power want. Now, this surely sounds conspiratorial, as though orders flow from some smoke-filled room and circulate a roll call and result in a certain number of gratuitous beatings on a certain evening. But that's not really the kind of thing that I mean. What I mean instead is that the apparent conflict between the law and police and police practices may not be so important as we tend to assume. The two may at times be at odds, but this is of little concern so long as the interests they serve are essentially the same. The police may violate the law as long as they do so in the pursuit of ends that people with power generally endorse and from which such people profit. This idea may become clearer if we consider police brutality and other illegal tactics in relation to lawful policing. When the police enforce the law, they do so unevenly, in ways that give disproportionate attention to the activities of poor people, people of color, and others near the bottom of the social hierarchy. And when the police violate the law, these same people are their most frequent victims. This is a coincidence too large to overlook. If we put aside for a moment all the questions of legality, it must become quite clear that the object of police attention and the target of police violence is overwhelmingly that portion of the population that lacks real power. And this is precisely the point. Police activities, legal or illegal, violent or nonviolent, tend to keep people who currently stand at the bottom of the social hierarchy in their place, at the bottom. Put differently, we might say that the police act to defend the interests and standing of those with power, those at the top. So long as they serve in this role, they are likely to be given a free hand in pursuing these ends and a great deal of leeway in pursuing other ends that they identify for themselves. The laws may say otherwise, but laws can be ignored. In theory, police authority is restricted by state and federal law as well as by the policies of individual departments. In reality, the police often exceed the bounds of their lawful authority. Okay, I guess he can slide. In reality, the police often exceed the bounds of their lawful authority and rarely pay any price for doing so. The rules are only as good as their enforcement, and they are seldom enforced. The real limits to police power are established not by statutes and regulations, since no law is self-enforcing, but by their leadership and indirectly by the balance of power in society. So long as the police defend the status quo, so long as their actions promote the stability of the existing system. Their misbehavior is likely to be overlooked. It is when their excesses threaten this stability that they begin to face meaningful restraints. Laws and policies can be ignored and still provide a cover of plausible deniability for those in authority. But when misconduct reaches such a level so as to provoke unrest, the authorities may have to tighten the reins for a while. Token prosecutions, minimal reforms, and other half-measures may give the appearance of change and may even serve as some check against the worst abuses, but they carefully fail to affect the underlying causes of brutality. It would be wrong to conclude that the police never change, but it is important to notice the limits of these changes, to understand the influences that direct them, and to recognize the interests that they serve. Police brutality is pervasive, systemic, and inherent to the institution. It is also anything but new. So I'm going to stop reading there and let you set the agenda for the rest of the time. If you have questions, I'll do my best to answer them, and if you have comments, I'd be glad to hear them.